Stop wasting your time.
And stop cheating yourself of a high-value social circle.
It's time to level up your game and lead your pack.
Say goodbye to going it alone and hello to unlocking your full potential.
The Art of Charms X Factor Accelerator is your ticket to transformation.
Don't wait another day to become the best version of yourself.
Our program is tailor-made for analytical minds like yours.
With weekly coaching, personalized sessions, and a roadmap to success.
Picture yourself walking into a room with confidence.
Forge genuine connections and attract the partner you've always wanted.
Backed by science, our program guarantees results.
Join executives, military personnel, and men just like you who found success with us. With over 17 years and 10,000 clients, our results speak for themselves.
With a money-back guarantee, how can you go wrong? Break free from the ordinary and step into the extraordinary.
Join us at unlockyourxfactor.com today and start your journey. Welcome to the Art of Charm podcast, where we break down the science of powerful communication and winning mindsets so you have the cheat code to succeed with people.
Every episode is jam-packed with actionable steps to unlock the hidden superpowers inside of you.
Level up with us each week by listening to interviews with the best in business, psychology, and relationships. We distill thousands of hours of research into the most effective tools and the latest science so you can start winning today.
Let's face it, in order to be seen and heard, your communication needs to cut through the noise, and we're going to show you how.
I'm AJ, successfully recovered introvert, entrepreneur, and self-development junkie.
And I'm Johnny Zuback, former touring musician, promoter, rock and roller, and co-founder here at The Art of Charm. And for the last 15 years, we've trained thousands of top performers and teams from every background. We have dedicated our lives to teaching men and women all they need to know about communication, networking, and relationships.
You shouldn't have to settle for anything less than extraordinary. Let's kick off today's show. Today, we have Dr. Judy Ho with us again, one of our most popular guests from 2020. We break down how attachment styles can hold you back in love and your career. Dr. Ho is a clinical neuropsychologist and a tenured professor and researcher at Pepperdine University. She also works as a forensic expert and media consultant. Last time, she joined us to talk about her book, Stop Self-Sabotage. And today, she's back to talk about her latest book, The New Rules of Attachment: How to Heal Your Relationships, Reparent Your Inner Child, and Secure Your Life Vision. We discuss why you need to understand your attachment style to build healthy relationships, how your attachment style impacts your work and social relationships. Judy also shares a couple of exercises to help you break free from your inner child wounds, and how parents can raise their children to be securely attached to achieve success and build healthy relationships. Well, welcome back to the show, Judy. Great to have you.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm excited to talk to you about attachment this time.
Last time you were here, we talked about self-sabotage.
Right.
And I think when it comes to relationships, attachment can be one of those ways that we actually sabotage relationships with others.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that it's kind of a hidden thing because you don't always think about or talk about attachment every single day, but it really takes a huge impact on your operating system. It's sort of like the way that you see the world and maybe some of the rules of how you interact with others and even how you feel about yourself. So there's a lot of impacts.
Well, I know that it's become more popular on social media to talk about attachment. There's memes flying around everywhere. But for those in our audience who aren't familiar with attachment theory, what is it?
So attachment theory is based on these early bonds that we have with our caregivers. Most of the times it's our parents, but it could be other important adults when you're just coming into the world. And the reason why these attachment bonds are so important is because you're just learning about how the world works, how you can affect change in the world. Do people come to you when you have a need? And in those early years, we're literally helpless without an adult to take care of us. And that's why they make such a huge impact on how we think about ourselves in the future.
Now, when it comes to attachment, I know that a lot of people can see it in others, but it's difficult to self-assess. So What are those four attachment styles? And then walk us through how we can start to understand ourselves versus labeling others as their attachment.
Yeah, so there's four attachment styles. One is secure. And so that's sort of considered to be like the optimal attachment type. And then there's three more insecure styles. They each have their sort of pros and cons that are associated with each one of them. And if you're not sure where to start, I do have an attachment quiz. You can see it on my website for free, or you can get it from my book. But that's a good way just to kind of understand yourself a little better. But the three insecure attachment styles, I'll start with the first one, is avoidant attachment style. So that one is a person who maybe in childhood they were parentified really early. Maybe they were made just to, in general, be more independent. They really couldn't count on their parents for various reasons. And I want to just also preface this by saying parents oftentimes are trying to do their best, but still, things happen. And so maybe really busy parents, for example, or parents who didn't really like to talk about emotions so much, they might produce an avoidantly attached child. And as an adult, these avoidantly attached are fiercely independent. They just want to do everything themselves, roll up their sleeves. When things get tough, they start to isolate. They don't tell people about their problems. And they tend to focus a lot of their life on their goals and their achievements. And they put less stock on deeper, meaningful connections with other people. The second kind of insecure attachment style is the anxious attachment style. So this is the quintessential people pleaser. Maybe when they were young, they felt like they had to do that to keep their parents close. And so as adults, they're generally having those same types of patterns in all the different areas of their life. They tend oftentimes to need a lot more positive reinforcement from their environment to feel good about themselves. So they might not be able to hold on to a higher self-esteem unless they're hearing it from everybody else that they're okay. And when they're away from people that they care about for too long, they start to question, like, do they still care about me? And they'll start to do these sort of like pulling behaviors for attention, even if they don't realize that that's what it is consciously. And then the last insecure attachment style is the disorganized. And that one, I think, is the most misunderstood. Yeah. When I look on online articles, social media, I see that people sometimes think that it's a combination of the other two styles, or they think that it's the style that it's just like you throw up your hands, you can't do anything about it because it's the most messed up one. Both of those things are untrue. People who develop disorganized attachment, they do tend to generally come from more stressful home environments and maybe ones that are traumatic. What happens is it makes it harder for them to emotionally regulate. So oftentimes they feel like there's a lot of chaos around them. They tend to get more overwhelmed with emotion. They tend to be in fight or flight a lot. So that's how they approach a lot of different things in their life, from relationships to career goals to even thoughts about themselves. And so it's just harder for them to kind of get to that base level of feeling safe and having stability. So that, I think, would describe the disorganized attachment well. And then finally, this is a secure attachment type. Doesn't mean that they don't have problems, but it does mean that when they do come across challenges, they feel more equipped that they can handle it either on their own or with someone's help. They generally believe that good things can happen to them and should happen to them. And their self-concept and their self-esteem tends to be pretty rooted in what they are doing internally. So it's not as predicated on whether or not they're achieving every day or what other people are saying about them.
Right. Now, looking at parents, for most of us, there's two people involved. So do parenting styles, combination of parenting styles, produce different attachments? Is a household primarily in one style or another?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I definitely think that whoever is your primary caregiver, that's oftentimes who your attachment style is going to be developed around. Okay. But obviously, if you have two parents who are pretty much equal in your life, even as a child, then if they have slightly differing styles, you might actually develop a combination attachment style. And then as an adult, it can play out in different areas of your life. So I've had people tell me, well, I have really secure attachment in my romantic relationships, but when it comes to my career, I feel like I'm more avoidantly attached. And then when it comes to friendships, I'm anxiously attached. Like, that's very common to have a combination attachment style. And sometimes certain situations trigger certain memories. And so it can even be something like, well, my mom and I, we've had a secure attachment, but my dad and I, we didn't. It was more insecure. And they find that playing out more when they interact with males. So you can see that too, where it's like the different domains of their life where these attachment styles can come up.
Okay. Now, there's a huge debate, nature, nurture. So what role do genetics play in attachment?
Huge. I mean, psychology is one of those fields where it would be nice if it was like a black and white answer, right? But it's always a combination. And so there's definitely the parents' parenting approach. And then there's the temperament, the personality of the infant and the toddler, right? And so some people, they come into the world and they just need a little bit more positive reinforcement than the average person. So if their parent is more dismissive of that, it's going to create in them a much more anxious attachment style as they grow up. Or you may have a child who was kind of independent to begin with, and they don't quite need as much. So even if the parent isn't there all the time and isn't giving them that extra reinforcement and nurturance, they might still grow up to be securely attached.
Okay.
Dissimilar to that first example I gave.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting that you point out romantic, social relationships, and then career relationships, because I think for a lot of us, we might first hear about attachment styles when it comes to our romantic relationships, because mm-hmm. those tend to be the relationships that we spend the most time in. Right. We get really close with the other person, and oftentimes we can actually see their response to our behavior, mm-hmm. and it leads to arguments and fights and conflict.
Yeah.
When it comes to our social relationships and our work relationships, those tend to be a little bit more difficult because we don't often get that direct feedback like we do from a romantic partner. I know yes. for myself, I'm avoidant mm-hmm. in a lot of ways, especially in romantic relationships. And I made that discovery through a partner breaking up with me and explaining to me all the behaviors that drove her up a wall. So yeah. when we look at these romantic bonds, are there patterns of attachment style that work well together, that tend to attract each other?
Yeah, such a great example. And thanks for sharing. I think I have avoidant attachment styles as well. And it's really through, like you said, you know, talking with my partners, trying to work on myself, that I'm like, okay, like, how do I do this in a way that will feel better for everybody yeah. and even myself involved? But yeah, definitely. I'm so used to being super independent that in my romantic relationships in the past, for sure, where it's just like, okay, I'm going to rather invest in something else rather than this emotional conversation, right? And so I think that, interestingly, avoidantly attached and anxiously attached tend to attract each other. It kind of makes sense. There's like a yeah. little chasing
people
and then
pleasing,
like,
and, yeah.
Yeah, like the people pleasing and then you're in it and then the person kind of goes away again and then like the anxiously attached like chases the avoidantly attached person. But then sometimes the anxiously attached person will start to feel overwhelmed and say, you know what, well, maybe this isn't working. They start to disconnect. And then that's when the avoidantly attached person will like go chase them and be like, wait, are we okay here? Like, let's make sure we're okay. And so you get into these patterns. And I think that oftentimes people are trying to replicate in some way, like making amends with something that had happened to them in the past at some point.
Yeah.
And that's why they start to attract each other. I think that that's probably the most common, but I think the disorganized attachment oftentimes will end up also attracting the avoidantly attached or the anxiously attached, just depending on where they are in their own self-development and how they're managing that. I think that in terms of what works well, I think any attachment style could really work well with any other, as long as you're willing to do the work and just have a little bit of insight. You know, you may always have the shadows of your primary attachment style coming back in, but as long as you have the self-awareness, you know how to switch the tactics, right? You know how to say, well, I have this urge now to kind of disconnect, or I have this urge now to people please, and what can I do instead? So I think that every style can work well with every other style. It's just about having that acknowledgement and wanting to change for the betterment of yourself and your partner.
So looking at those family relationships and their importance on child rearing and our outcomes in terms of attachment style, for those in our audience who are parents, it sounds like we want to raise secure attachment style children. What can we do to be better parents around raising secure attachment?
Yeah, so interesting, because I had this idea for this book for several years. I pitched it. I got the book bought by Hachette, and then I became pregnant. So it was so interesting that just coincidentally, in a way, the timing of it was, now I'm writing this book while I'm trying to raise my infant son.
Yeah.
And really, all of the things that I know as an expert, what I've been talking about with parents, trying to help my clients, now I'm living it. Now I'm living it also on top of it. And I think parenting is so huge. I think that a lot of times people put so much stock in their parenting. Makes sense, because you're like, I have one chance to do it right. But I also think the 80-20 rule applies here, okay. where 80% of the time, if you're doing things to foster secure attachment, your child's probably going to end up being securely attached. 20% of the time, you make mistakes. You were, you know, slightly just, you know, busy with something else, like did something differently and wish you didn't do it that way. Most of the times, it's still going to be okay. I think in general, all you really need to do as a parent is just be a mindful parent. Just be attentive to what your child is needing in the moment. Earlier, you brought up this idea of nature versus nurture. You can read all the parenting books in the world, go see all the therapists you want, and you just have to look at your child. What works for your child might not work for another child. What works for your firstborn child might not work for your lastborn child. And so it's really just about being observant of what your child needs and your child's temperament, and then just doing your best to be there for them and addressing whatever needs are coming up in the moment. You don't even necessarily have to have a defined script. It's really just about what they need every single day. One day they might be totally fine being more independent, playing on their own. The next day they might want more hugs and just want to be close to you. And so I've talked to a lot of different parents, especially being a new parent myself. And it's so interesting that a lot of them have had these same revelations of, oh, like I had this whole day planned where we're going to do all these activities. And really all they wanted me to do today was just like sit with them on the couch and just be near me physically. And then that's kind of what we ended up doing instead of all these other activities that we had planned. And so I think that that is so much of what we need as human beings to feel secure and safe in those early years, is just a close proximity emotionally and physically to someone who cares. So that's kind of it. Like I'm boiling down parenting to maybe like super simple terms, but I think that that's really the key.
Versus overcomplicating it and trying to turn it into something that in a lot of ways forces children to be outside of their comfort zone, to be outside of who they were meant to be.
Exactly. And I know that sometimes it comes from a good place. You know, you oftentimes hear about parents saying, well, I really wanted my child to have certain opportunities that I didn't get to have.
Right.
Of course, that's great. But you also have to watch your child and you also have to say, is this appropriate for my child? And so obviously at the extreme, you have these parents who are saying, well, I never got to be a figure skater. So like my child's going to be a figure, you know, and then like drive them really hard to do it. And then it makes it feel really difficult if that child is just not into it, or they feel like, well, everything about me is that it's all based on my achievements and what I do for you. Like that will produce a certain type of child that might be insecurely attached. And so I do think that sometimes we're overcomplicating it. And it is just about watching your child and giving your child what they need in that moment. And that's going to make them feel safe. And that's going to make them feel secure.
So looking at attachment styles, basically how we are raised in that parental person, both presence in our life, that primary caregiver, is kind of the set point of what we see safety and comfort and love as.
Right.
And then we seek that out in other relationships, whether that be personal, whether that be romantic. When you recognize that maybe you have one of these insecure attachment styles, what is the work? Because you said do the work to actually become secure. What is that work that we should be doing once we've recognized these patterns in ourselves?
So once you recognize the patterns, and I think, you know, you said something like template, you know, it is kind of a template that you go about life. And to me, it's sort of like an operating system that's always working underneath. And although most of the times we're talking about romantic relationships, like you said, it does affect all the different areas of your life. It affects how you go about goals. It affects how you deal with friendships and family members. It affects how you think about yourself, just in general, your whole self-concept. And so once you recognize the insecure attachment, then it's really about looking at the operating system and essentially changing what's not working, developing a revised operating system that's actually going to work for your life right now as an adult. And so what I have found is that with each insecure attachment type, they have certain different things that are running as their program. So for example, the anxious attached, a lot of what's running in their program is, you know, I have to overanalyze everything. That's part of the anxious temperament. Or, I have to save others. I have to, you know, take care of others, because otherwise they won't take care of me or they won't like me. And so once you realize what these statements are, there's different exercises that you can do to essentially reparent yourself. And that is what I think is really important, is that sometimes people will say, well, okay, like I get all that and I hear what you're saying. And like, I've talked to my parents about it and they're just like, what are you talking about? They're clearly not interested in the work. And maybe they don't even feel like they want to take responsibility for what they've contributed to my attachment style. But that's okay. The whole idea is that as an adult now, you have more efficacy and you have more control, and it's in your hands now. So you can be upset with your parents, but this is not about blaming them, because it's not going to help you move forward. So what can you do? You have to learn to reparent yourself. You have to reprogram what's happened. And so there's different exercises that we can do, from inner child work to mirror work to like shadow work to empty chair exercises. But these are things where you get to confront those areas that have developed from an earlier time, these scripts that probably no longer work in your life, but you're still running those old programs. It's like that like old computer that you're still using, but it's just not working now. And so it is up to you to be able to do those exercises and move forward and develop these new scripts for yourself.
So it is important to recognize, as you said earlier, that, you know, our parents are doing the best they can with what they're given. And of course, a lot of this information wasn't even available to them around raising kids, podcasts, videos, inner child work. So recognizing that we have to take responsibility and we want to have healthy, happy relationships in our lives. I found in our work that we do as with clients is we tend to get a lot of avoidant attachment clients as well, being very goal-driven and lone wolves, as we call them, just happy to push relationships to the side, focus on the task at hand. So walk us through some of these exercises for those in the audience who are avoidant to actually start to work through breaking that pattern and getting to a more secure attachment style in their life.
Yeah, this is a great question, you know, and I think, again, the avoidantly attached is interesting because I also talk about the pros of each insecure attachment style because there's so much about how bad they are that it's important to also recognize their strengths, right? And so interestingly, like you said, avoidantly attached individuals, they are the proverbial lone wolves and they are admired for it. They're admired for their achievements. So it's kind of egocentric to be avoidantly attached. And then obviously when they're not feeling good about themselves, they like just set up another goal and they do it. And people are like, whoa, you're so amazing. You have all this stuff going on in your personal life and you're still doing it. And so it makes you kind of almost drive even more towards that. But eventually you burn out more. Your self-concept is obviously not in a great place in that it's always predicated on what you're achieving. And then we all need connection, like even the proverbial lone wolves, even if you say you're a recluse, because we're social animals. I mean, that's a lot of what your work is on, is trying to help people recognize that and harness that. And so a lot of the exercises for our proverbial lone wolves really have to do with developing healthy interdependence. And so I set up these behavioral experiments for them. I know that you like them too in your program, where you start to little by little, you know, starting with lower stake things, like ask people to start helping in different areas of your life. But you start with lower stakes because it's too scary to ask like the big ass of most intimate relationships. But you start with that. But you, the important thing is that you actually write your hypothesis beforehand, right? So it's like, what do you think is actually going to happen versus what actually happens? And oftentimes people who have avoidant attachment, they feel like, well, they're not going to be able to do it. Or like, well, they'll do it, but they'll disappoint me. Or like, they'll do it, but then now they're going to think that I suck and I'm weak. Right. And so it's important to write those hypotheses ahead of time because our minds are so powerful that later on after something happens, you're going to create the story that still fits your current ideas.
Yeah.
So you have to write it down ahead of time. Then you do the experiment and then you're like, okay, well, what actually happened? And then you look at the discrepancies and you have to start in a logical way, actually make sense of, oh, okay, what's the new idea then to bring into my existing script? So I guess I asked this person for this. I thought that they were totally going to disappoint me. And you know what? They did pretty good job. Like, could I have done a better job? Maybe, but they did a pretty good job. Yeah. They did a good enough job that I feel more comfortable doing it in the future. You know, with people that you have more intimate relationships with, you can even ask them directly, like, when I asked you for this, what did you think of me? You know, people you trust, your friends, close family, romantic partners. And, you know, most of the times you're going to get that feedback of like either nothing or like, well, yeah, obviously you need a lot of help. You have a lot on your plate as opposed to you're
bothering
weak.
Me. Yeah.
Yeah, you're bothering me. Exactly. And so I think those behavioral experiments are so important for the avoidant attached because avoidantly attached people are really pragmatic. They tend to be really logical and they don't want like so much emotional content. And so you got to meet the types where they're at. If you're asking the avoidantly attached to do a ton of really deep emotional work right off the bat, they're going to run away from that.
They're going to pick
like,
another goal.
This doesn't fit me. Yeah, exactly.
Johnny, we know if you listen to the show, you are driven. In fact, we're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed.
Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster.
And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey.
Our hiring needs are broad in scope, and Indeed makes things easy and fast and organized. I don't know what we would do without Indeed.
Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every single day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets.
Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/charm. Just go to Indeed.com/charm right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Yeah. And with that, you know, recognizing that, yes, we have these big goals, but we get these goals achieved so much faster with just a little bit of support, with just a little bit of help from our community. And they feel good helping you, right? I think that's one of the things that's challenging with the lone wolf mindset is like, well, I can get there faster alone. It's like, no, actually you can get there faster with support. And the people want to support you. They care about you. They see you in such high regard because of all of your achievements that they're excited to be a part of your journey.
Exactly. And I think that that's something that is a huge takeaway for the avoidantly attached, because like you said, there's all of these different things, ideas that you've put in your head that you're doing it better alone. And because 95% of the time you're doing it alone, you're reinforcing that yourself. But once you actually let other people in, you realize, like you said, your goals are much better achieved with people supporting you, and you're actually giving them a gift. Oftentimes they like want to, and they feel privileged that you asked.
Right, to be a part of it.
Yeah, and so that's why these feedback conversations after the fact are so important. It's like the people that you do trust that are kind of in your inner circle, like, how did you feel doing this? Like, you need that feedback. You need to remember that for the next time, and you need to write it down so you don't forget or create a different narrative that fits your existing ideas.
Absolutely. I know for myself, growing up, I was in a household where my emotions were often dismissed. Mm-hmm. So expressing emotions, especially quote unquote negative emotions, was just not seen as comfortable for me, even after growing up and becoming an adult. And in those relationships, your partner can sense that you're feeling difficult emotions. You're not hiding it. You're not getting anything under your partner's nose. But with that, they feel disconnected from you because you're not showing your true self.
Exactly. And I really resonates with me as well, because, you know, growing up in a more traditional Chinese household, stoicism is very valued. And so when you have negative emotions, they are dismissed. It's like, well, don't complain about it, or don't talk about it, right? And that was my parents' way of cheering me up, though, right? Yeah. Whenever I had a hard time, when I had a difficult time. And so again, I recognized that my parents were only using the scripts that they grew up with, and they were actually trying to help. But it definitely made me feel like, oh, we just don't talk about negative emotions. And I remember that earlier in my life, I was pretty uncomfortable when people became more emotional around me. And when they were expressing negative emotion, I was like, oh my God, like, it would make me super uncomfortable. I would either try to like make an excuse to get out of there, or it would just make me even more stoic, which would drive the person crazy.
Right.
Cause they're like, are you even hearing me?
I'm distressed.
And I'm like, everything's fine. They're like, no, it's not, you know? And so it actually fires them up more, which obviously achieves the opposite effect.
Yeah.
And so it does take some time, like you said, like to try to show up authentically, to recognize that negative emotions serve a function. So again, speaking to the more logical and pragmatic mind of my brain, I had to tell myself, you know what? All emotions exist for a reason. They're evolutionarily adaptive. If you didn't have negative emotions, how would you know something was wrong? Like, negative emotions are what propels fight or flight when you actually need it, right? And so the negative emotion, if we can just develop an attitude of curiosity towards it, like, oh, well, I'm feeling this. Why am I feeling this? What is it trying to tell me about my life? Maybe there's something that I need to address. If you can take that attitude of curiosity and approach it as an intellectual exercise, maybe that's a little bit easier of a bridge for people who tend to be more avoidantly attached with their emotions. And so it's interesting now, like on the other side, since I've done so much self-development work on my own, that now I'm like, my feelings matter. Like, I wanna, if I feel this way today, like, it's okay. Like, and it's funny because I feel like it took a lot of time for me to get to that place where that's more comfortable for me. But even as I'm saying it now, sometimes I'm like, no, too much emotion. Like, there's still an old script that sometimes tries to interfere with the newer development.
So I think that's an important point in all of this, that it's not this like complete erase of those memories and erase the script. It's always going to be there. It's just how are you reacting to it? Are you able to recognize it? And are you able to move against it, away from it, or towards the things that really matter to you in those moments? And now you know, in a loving, caring relationship, well, your partner wants to see all of the emotions from you. They want to see the positive and the negative emotions. They want to see the excitement, and they want to know when your heart is broken, because that's what real support is. I know in my situation with my family, a lot of their view on negative emotions were they were contagious. So like, get that negativity away from me. Or even worse, like, hey, you made someone at the family gathering feel this way because you were acting this way. So act in a different way. Don't show that negative emotion because you hurt Aunt Jerry. And it's like, well, I didn't mean to hurt Aunt Jerry. I was just trying to express myself. So in a lot of ways, I walled off all of those emotions in relationships. Mm-hmm. And I went through a period of grief and losing my dad. And, you know, it actually disconnected me from my friends because mm-hmm. they had no idea how to even communicate with me because I just right. wasn't being open and honest about the grief I was feeling. And I just didn't want to answer their call. I didn't want to talk to them. I didn't want to dump yeah. those emotions on them.
Right. Yeah. And I think that that is so true that, again, as the proverbial lone wolf, you do try to go through all the most challenging times of your life on your own. But that can be so hard, and it becomes like the self-perpetuating cycle too. And then again, that reinforces these ideas like, well, people can't be counted on. It's like, well, but you haven't asked for help either, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, this is huge that most people with avoidant attachment, they're always afraid of being a burden to others. And like you said, there's some earlier experiences that may have caused that. And so as an adult, when those ideas still come up, like you said, it's not black or white. It's not like, okay, once the healing work is done, like it's never going to come up again. But that doesn't mean that you haven't gotten to the other side. It's more just about, oh, now I recognize what it is. And so can I do something different? And what you were alluding to earlier about like living the values-based life still, you know, like, okay, well, I am in distress right now. It's a little chaotic, but what can I still do to like drive towards the things that mean the most to me? So that's a great turn to say, okay, what are my top three values today? And what's one small thing I can do to move each of those things forward and just feel like I'm still living that truth? You know, that's really important. Even being an avoidantly attached person, wanting every day to be super productive and super goal-oriented and then beating yourself up when you're not having that day. Well, you know what? Some days aren't going to be like that for a variety of reasons, but are you still living a values-based life? And if you are, then you can go to sleep like feeling good about yourself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's really the power in values over goals. Goals yeah. are important, but if you orient your entire life around goals, there are going to be periods where you aren't reaching them, where you're falling yeah. further away from them, where yeah. for completely outside of your control circumstances, you just can't achieve them. But values are a way of being that you can incorporate into your daily life, whether or not you're feeling a negative emotion, a positive emotion, you've had a distressful experience at work, you've had a coworker who put something on you that you didn't deserve, you can still live in a value-based life, even if your goal is to be promoted.
Exactly. And I think that that's why it's so important to know that truly mindful living, it actually is going to move the needle forward more in the long run, even if one or two days you just have blips where you're like, I'm not doing as much, you know?
Right.
And it is about like, where am I today and how am I feeling and what's going on? And sometimes there's things out of our control. People with avoidant attachment, especially, they want to try to control everything. It's like, well, I'm going to do everything myself. Some things are out of your hands and you're just going to have to let it go. And that's another important lesson of, you know, how do we actually achieve that more balanced self-concept of, yes, my achievements are so important. I own that. That's a big part of my identity. But there's also times where being interdependent with somebody else, like that should be just as important. Or if I'm not able to move towards my goals as quickly as I can, I still feel good about myself at the end of the day. And I think the secret is mindfulness and values-based life.
Yeah, I think in my own personal journey, one of the unlocks for me were helping other people reach their goals mm-hmm. and the feeling that gave me around fulfillment and joy in my own life, yeah. recognizing that, well, if I let other people in on my goals as the lone wolf, they can feel that as well. So yes. really recognizing those behaviors and actions in others, being self-reflective and saying, oh, okay, that's the gift that I'm giving to these people that I share my goals with, that I ask for that support from.
Right, exactly. Because at the end of the day, we all want to be connected with other people. We all want to say like we made a positive impact in someone else's life.
Yeah.
And yeah, like it's an interesting challenge of, hey, why are you taking that away from people who care about you? Like they actually want to be part of your journey and they want to see you on the other side.
I think part of the problem that I see on social media around the labeling of attachment is the negative feelings that it fosters, the beating up of yourself, the judgment, the critique. And I think a big part of this is developing self-compassion, recognizing wow. that, hey, this is a pattern that, again, was out of your control based on the way you were raised, environment, genetics, all the things that go into that attachment style, understanding that there's going to be some work if you want to move towards secured, but at the same time, recognizing that, hey, there were some benefits to having this attachment and allowed me to reach some goals, some success in my life. It hasn't been all negative.
Exactly.
So what are some ways that we can develop self-compassion towards our current attachment?
Yeah, this is such a huge, I'm so glad that you brought that up. It's so true. We have such difficulty being self-compassionate. And oftentimes you know that you have problems with self-compassion if you're pretty critical of other people. Like, because the rules come from somewhere. Like, so if you're upset with people for things, it's like, actually, there's a part of you that's upset with yourself, you know? And having compassion is so important. I think that one thing is moving past anger. I think that sometimes people will have a lot of anger either toward themselves for having an insecure attachment style now and like maybe the negative impacts it's had, or like anger toward their parents. Like, yeah. I'm so mad at you because you made me do this, or like you made me this way. And I get that that's oftentimes the first step. You have to have something to direct your upset at. But eventually you have to move past that and say, how can I honor myself and value myself just as I am, because all human beings have worth regardless of our mistakes, regardless of what we've done, regardless of the mistakes in the past. And until you can achieve that self-compassion, you really can't move forward in a positive way, because there's always going to be something that gets you stuck or sabotages your best efforts. So one of the things that I love the most about, self-compassion at work is really just about like sitting with your inner child. So your inner child is that metaphorical little you that still lives in all of us. And you've probably seen your inner child come out when you're stressed and you just want to play video games forever, or like do something that like makes you happy from childhood. Yeah. You're like, I don't care about any of my responsibilities.
Or have a tantrum, kick, scream, tantrum. And cry. Yeah,
exactly. And like, and if you can have compassion towards your inner child, then it's going to heal your adult self and give your adult self some compassion too. Oftentimes, I think as an adult, we push our inner child aside because we're like, no, like that's the tantrumy, like irresponsible little child. I don't want to recognize it. But if you don't, you're never going to have compassion for yourself. So one exercise I love to do is a visualization exercise where you essentially picture your inner child at whatever age you want to. It could be 5, it could be 3, it could be 10. Maybe going through a difficult time. Maybe you can just reflect upon like, what was a difficult moment during my elementary years or junior high years? And then just, you know, really bring that picture of your inner child to life as much as possible. And then imagine your adult self meeting your inner child and essentially asking your inner child, what do you need? Like, just that simple question, what do you need? And then just listening and seeing what your inner child's telling you. Maybe your inner child is saying like, I just need a hug, or like, I just needed to be told that I'm okay, even if I didn't get that A, you know. But whatever the case is, you know, really recognize that that's something that your inner child is still carrying with you and is probably affecting you to this day. And then thinking about, in the next 24 hours, what's one small thing I can do to like meet this need of my inner child? Mm. So if they're saying like, I need to be told that I'm okay, even if I'm not achieving, it's like, okay, well, as the adult self, I have a lot more resources. I have a lot more wherewithal, control over my life. Like, what is something that I can do to nurture that part of myself? And if you do this exercise even weekly, you're going to start to notice that you have so much more compassion for yourself, because you're basically saying, hey, you're my inner child. You're allowed to come and express your emotions and your needs to me at any time. My adult self will help take care of it. And it gives you that bond of it's okay. Even if you're telling me something that like my adult self is saying, whoa, that sounds really childish or like really unreasonable. But the more that you actually dialogue with your inner child, the more you'll realize this is not unreasonable. This is something that a human being needs, and I can give that to my own self. And that is compassion. That is a form of self-compassion that is very real and that you can take with you.
Yeah. It's recognizing that that part of yourself that's still present from childhood is creating these patterns that are coming up in relationships, communication, the way you see the world, and recognizing that, hey, that operating system in that moment, I understand where it comes from. I understand how it gave you safety and security and love in that situation. It doesn't work in this moment, and I still care and love you. I think that you're capable, even if you're feeling this way, even if that insecurity is at its peak.
Exactly. And I think that that is so important, because our inner child is still operating in our adult selves like all the time, you know, and especially when we're stressed. And so if you're able to do this type of exercise, especially when you're stressed, you're basically saying, hey, it's okay. And it's kind of like every child that you've ever been around, they're like having a tantrum, but like you basically say, hey, I'm here, or like, okay, let's do this. Like, they calm down, right? It's like, they only get louder if they don't feel like they're being heard. So if you can say, hey, I hear you, like that might even be enough. If you're like, hey, I don't have any great ideas of how I'm going to help you today, but at least I hear you and I accept what you're saying, that might be enough to get you through that next challenge.
Yeah. And one of the visualizations that we do in our program is in that moment where you're feeling that stress and that ultimate insecurity, taking it to its conclusion that, you know, maybe you just want to be loved, or maybe yes. you feel that person hates you, or you're never enough, or you're a complete failure. And then picturing yourself as a child saying that out loud to you. Yeah. And how would you respond? Would you agree and say, yeah, you're a complete failure and no one loves you
right.
to you as a child? No,
right.
You would give that child a hug. You would give that child compassion in that moment if they were saying it. But somehow when we're saying it as an adult, we give it more weight. We give it more credence. We believe it.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And like you said, you know, when you really turn it around and you say, would you really chastise that child that way? This like crying child at the age of 5 and say, no, it's not okay to feel that way. No, you would, like you said, give them a hug. Give them encouragement. But as an adult, we feel like we're supposed to have it all together and like we can't express those feelings anymore. But that child essentially shows you like one of the purest forms of being human.
Yeah.
Because it's before there was all these social constructs. It was before they thought that there were certain ways they had to act. And so it's showing you like the purest form of here's what I need to self-actualize. Here's what I need to feel safe so I can actually do the things that are meaningful to me. And it might be a little easier when you picture that to say, yes, I accept that and I can give that to you versus our adult self. But eventually, that's the connection. The connection is that you're giving that to your adult self. You're giving them that permission.
Now, with attachment styles and relationships in general, there's typically another person involved in the relationship. And I know one of the questions that we hear from our clients once they start working on their attachment style is they become really in tune with their partner's attachment style. And sometimes it can actually drive them crazy. It can feel very frustrating that you're doing the work on yourself, you're overcoming these patterns, and maybe your partner's not moving along, and maybe your partner doesn't want to deal with these patterns. Yeah. So what is your advice in that situation when you feel that maybe the relationship and the work you've done on yourself isn't being met and your needs aren't being met in this relationship?
Yeah, it can be really frustrating because, you know, oftentimes one partner will be ahead of the other partner in self-development. And it doesn't mean that that relationship is not going to work.
Yeah.
But you also have to show up authentically and let your partner know what's bothering you. And so again, we've been talking a lot about avoidant attachment because I know it speaks a lot to your audience. And, you know, the avoidantly attached person might just be like starting to disassociate from them, like just start to go away and be like, well, this might not work for me anymore. Like you have to challenge yourself to say, no, like this is a time to communicate it and say, look, we don't have to have the same journey, but I've been frustrated because I feel like I'm working so hard on having better communication with you, but I don't really feel like it's going both ways. So like, what do you think about that? And what do you think is a way that we can improve our relationship? Put it in the other person's court after communicating, because you don't want them to feel like they're being accused, right? So you don't want to say, well, I think that you don't want to work on yourself because you don't care about self-development. No, you should just talk about what you're observing, right? Stick to things that you can actually look at. It's like a research study. Like just what can you observe from the outside? But don't make any presumptions about their intentions. And then put the ball in their court. Like, what do you think? And how do you think we can improve? Because I want to be more connected to you. I want us to feel happier in this relationship. And so I think that that's really the first step. It's not really about like throwing up your hands and giving up on it, but just letting them know like, this doesn't feel good to me. So what can we do to like meet this need together? Because this relationship is important to me.
It's really two patterns combining into one in a relationship. And depending how long you've been in that relationship together, well, those patterns become quite comfortable for both of you, how you're showing up. And now you're doing all this work, you're breaking your pattern in the relationship. Well, it is going to cause discomfort in your partner. They're not going to know necessarily how to show up now because it's different than how you've showed up in the past and in arguments and conflicts and in distress. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, it might get worse before it gets better. It almost always does with any kind of change, whether it's parenting or relationships or even like corporate structures. You know, something that we talk about a lot is like family systems theory, which is like when somebody in the family system all of a sudden doesn't do what they used to do, for better or for worse, like that throws the system into chaos. It's like, oh no, you were supposed to be the black sheep of the family. Now you're getting your shit together and like you're doing all, like that freaks people out, you know? Yeah. So you have to also give your partner a little grace that, oh wait, like they used to communicate this other way. Now they're doing this. What does that mean for me? Like, how does that mean about my communication with them? And so it does take time. It does take effort, but you can always restructure the system for the better, whether it's a partnership, a family, or like a work team.
Let's talk about that family environment, because I know with a lot of this work, outside of the anger and resentment we talked about, but with family, we might just want to start over and create fresh communication now that we've recognized this pattern. And maybe in the past, in that situation and family conflict, you would just become avoidant and not answer their call or not agree to go to the family trip. But now you want to be a bigger part of the family system. How do you make change in that environment where it's now a dynamic that really has been well-worn, probably lasted longer than a lot of our romantic and personal relationships?
Yeah. So I think that the first key is really just to start practicing active listening as a family. So this is something that we do a lot of in therapy. We talk about it a lot in therapy, but I feel like it just has so many different applications so that we can really listen to understand. Yeah. Oftentimes when we're talking to other people, even in a social environment, we're like thinking about what we're going to say next. Like you're saying something to me and I'm like, oh, I really want to say this other thing. But then you start missing part of the actual conversation they're really trying to communicate. It's kind of about trusting yourself that you know that you're going to come up with the next logical thing to say or the next interesting or helpful thing to say, but that's easier said than done. So active listening has a very easy script. Essentially, somebody else is going to communicate for a little bit. You're going to try to listen and be as attentive as possible. When they're done, the thing that you're going to say is just trying to recap what they said. And it can be in your own words. You don't have to use their words, right? It's just kind of summarizing and paraphrasing. And then that gives the other person a chance to say, yeah, that's what I was saying. Or, well, actually, you missed this one piece. Or like, no, that was not right, but let me try again. But it's so helpful because then you're not carrying with the miscommunication of what you heard and then that fueling what you say next, right? So even just that piece, it slows down the communication. It makes sure that it's actually accurate, what's being communicated. And then the second step is just affirming something about what you heard. So once the person says, okay, that's pretty much what I said, like that sounds good. The next thing you can say is, okay, so based on what you said, like this was interesting to me, or like I totally resonate with this and understand it, or like even though I don't agree, I can empathize with how you're feeling, right? It's not really about, oh, now we all agree with each other, but it's just about, is there something that you can acknowledge in what they said that like resonates with you, that you have more questions about, that like makes sense? Like that's all we're asking. We're not saying you have to agree on everything, but that is just a huge key to like start breaking down any old patterns that aren't working in your family system and starting to communicate in a better way that makes everybody feel heard.
I feel in a lot of ways with that anger and resentment bubbling up, there can be no room for forgiveness and you might even want to cut your family off and completely disassociate from your family. How can we practice forgiveness in these situations? Again, hearkening back to what we said earlier, that our parents were trying the best they could in a situation that they were in, and they did care and love for us, even if they're bringing past patterns and their own attachment theory into the way they're raising us.
Yeah, definitely. I think that anger can be such a powerful emotion. It's such a strong cover for more vulnerable emotions that oftentimes we just want to live in it forever because it sometimes feels more comfortable to be angry than to be sad or to be disappointed or to be heartbroken, right? And so kind of recognizing that anger actually doesn't really help you. Like anger really manifests in such terrible emotional and physical ways, especially if it's chronic. So like, of course, you should let yourself be angry, but like let yourself also move past it after that initial phase. And basically say, okay, I don't have to be so in love with my mom and dad now. Like all of a sudden I'm like pretending that everything's fine. Like, that's not what we're talking about. But it's more about, can we go back and just recognize like one thing that they gave me today that like is a positive, you know? I mean, that's a start of just one little, even if it's a little thing, even if it's like, well, like because they were so anxious, like I guess like it made me more aware of like potential dangers, even if it's sometimes overboard.
Yeah.
But like, It has helped me in some ways to be more cautious, maybe when I should, right? It can be any little thing. And then I think it's really just also about recognizing that you can do this in doses. It doesn't mean that you now all of a sudden want to like spend a whole weekend with your parents, but it could be like, you know what? Like, let's just start by saying like, let's go get lunch and let's keep it low key. Let's like have an end time because I don't know if I want to hang out with them for 3 hours. But it's just about letting yourself do this in the doses that feel comfortable to you. And you should throw out whatever presuppositions you have about what you're supposed to do as a good child or like how you're supposed to heal. It's like, if you don't want to talk to them after the lunch for 3 weeks, like that's okay too. You know, like you just have to meet yourself where it's at. But I think that it's always important to kind of think about, we only have this one life. We only have limited time. Like, is your true goal never to speak to your parents again and never have a relationship? And if it's not, like, let's meet them where they're at and let's value and cherish the good of the relationship.
Yeah. It could definitely be a challenge. And of course, we want it to happen fast and quickly, but it doesn't always work that way in a family dynamic and a family system.
Yeah. And I think that a big part of it is also forgiving yourself. You know, sometimes that anger, it's really hiding that there's parts of yourself that you resent, you know, because sometimes when we resent what our parents have taught us, the biggest realization is that maybe some of those lessons still seeped into how you were.
How we are, yeah.
And then so like there's a little bit of like self-hatred in there that maybe we need to resolve too. And so until you can kind of see the other side of, okay, there's still some good that came out of this, you have to recognize it in yourself as well as, you know, other people for that work to be complete.
Going back to the earlier part around anxious attachment and in career. So I know for a lot of our clients, they don't want to change their anxious yeah. attachment in their career. And oftentimes it leads to difficult relationship building at the career level. And it leads to you feeling that you're only as good as your last achievement, when in actuality, your network can create more achievement and more opportunity in your career. So what is your advice when it comes to breaking free of that anxious attachment in our career?
Yeah, I think it can be so easy to say, you know what, like I am responsible solely for what I'm doing and I have to keep achieving and I can't let anyone stop me. So then instead of seeing other people as resources and support, you see them as enemies. You see them
as competition.
You see them as barriers to your success. And so it's not going to be something that you can do overnight, but it is something where you start to value other people for the areas that they're good at. One of the things that has helped me the most is really connecting with people who have like slightly different expertises than me, but there's some overlap because I know that I'm learning something from them. And then maybe that's the first step of like, oh, I see the value in what you're bringing. And then slowly understanding that really it's these collective minds that allows like bigger opportunities. I've always found that when I start talking to somebody about an idea, it sparks other ideas. Like there's only so much your one brain can do, but maybe the little space to like start the work is to find other people whose expertises are like slightly different from yours, but there's some overlap in interest or skill set, so that there's a mutual respect of, well, I don't know as much about this area, so that's something that you can tell me about. It's really interesting. There was actually a really cool research study that was done with elementary students, and it was helping them to foster collaboration. And what they did was they would break up a project into four pieces. It was like a jigsaw. So essentially, you really could not finish a project unless you listened to the other person. So it's almost like everybody has like one part of a short story, but then you needed to make a summary of that story. So then like one person has like the first page, the second person, the second page. So you literally remove them from being able to do the work completely by themselves. Yeah. And you have to listen to the person recap page two for you, or else you won't have the whole story. So it's almost like that kind of idea when we're thinking about how to work in teams and how to help people with avoidant attachment start to rely on others, is like, let's bring in somebody who has something that you don't. And like the in for you is I get to learn something that helps me towards my goals, but you start to recognize the value of other people when you start working in this way.
Yeah, and that reciprocity of delegation, right?
Yeah.
Recognizing that starting small with delegating tasks and then also supporting others and taking on some tasks that maybe aren't directly your goals and oriented around what you want to achieve can start to break through that piece around vulnerability and starting to trust others in your work.
Yeah, and then I think once you start to have more positive experiences, it's going to start bringing you more towards like a balanced, more secure attachment when you say, oh, you know what? Maybe there are some things that I should be doing because I really am the best at them. I've been working on it. But there are other people who can help with these other pieces. And in turn, I can help them too. And like, that'll help both of our achievements, you know?
Yeah. I know in my own experience, I was in a lot of ways just starved for appreciation. And I found it only when I achieved big, lofty goals, like getting into college and getting into graduate school. But outside of that, in the day-to-day where I really needed some appreciation and pep talk, I wasn't getting it from my family structure. And then it became very difficult for me as I moved into leadership role to then appreciate those around me, because I'm like, well, it's not a big goal. Like we have bigger goals that we have to focus on. And I started just with our team, just focusing on appreciating more frequently and seeing how powerful that was. And and now I incorporate that with all of our clients that work with us who have this tendency to just start recognizing the talents, the gifts that other people around you have and verbalizing it. Share that appreciation, see their response, see how it impacts their work. And you're going to find by leading that oftentimes you'll hear that appreciation back.
Exactly. I think when you're in a leadership role, so much of it is like an opportunity to also help heal insecure attachment in your teammates and like employees and people that you're supervising. But it's so interesting when you said that, you know, as an avoidantly attached person, like because you weren't getting as much of that, like it also didn't really necessarily occur to you to do that for others like automatically until you started saying, hey, you know what, this could actually be of such value. And it's so important that we all recognize that, like obviously we're all coming from our own experiences and sort of how we operate, and then learning how important and how much like just one sentence of appreciation is like just goes such a long way for people to invest more, to feel good about themselves, and then to like actually start to spark ideas of self-initiation of like, oh, what can I do next to like get the next accolade? Like, I want to have some more positive reinforcement, or like, I want to help this person. Like, they've helped me. They made me feel good about myself. Like, so I now want to go to bat for them, you know? So even as a leader or a manager, I think that it's important to recognize that, that no matter what attachment style you're working with, most people want to be acknowledged and appreciated in different ways. You know, it's kind of like a love language that I think is relatively universal.
Absolutely. The validation piece and just being fully seen in the work that you're doing. Because I know for a lot of us, especially at this stage in our career, those goals are big and they take a long time to be reached at a company level. And if we're not appreciating all the steps along the way, it can feel very daunting, demotivating. It can work against our productivity and our mental health in a work environment.
Exactly. And I think sometimes we think, well, no, like we don't want to, you know, recognize the small things because then they might like not keep their eye on the prize. But actually it helps people to keep their eye on the prize to say, I do recognize what you did today. And I know that there's still a lot before we get to that big goal. But like what you did today was helpful. It was instrumental. Meaningful. It helped move the needle.
Yeah. Now, I have to ask what the listeners are probably thinking at this point. Is the goal secure attachment? Like if I've recognized that I'm anxious or avoidant, should I be working really hard and reading your book to become secure attachment? Or can I live with my current attachment and improve on the way that I'm interacting in relationships?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. I mean, I think that there's obviously a lot to take away from the secure attachment style. And I think that probably for most people, the goal is to become more securely attached. But I also think that in the name of self-compassion, like we've been talking about throughout, you know, our time together, it's also about just like recognizing and like honoring where you are. And if your avoidant attachment just keeps showing up, it's okay. Like there's nothing wrong with that either. It's like, okay, well, how can I harness the strengths of it? And then try not to let the things that it might cause problems with like get the best of me. And that's really all that it is. I mean, I actually think that, you know, every single attachment style, even the insecure ones, come with pros. And so it's really just about leveraging the pros. You know, we spent less time talking about anxious attachment, but anxious attachment, oftentimes they're people pleasers. They're always wanting to bend over backwards to help other people. So are we saying throw that out with the bathwater? No. We're just saying, hey, you know what? Like, think about yourself sometimes though too. And also, this is not the only way to get reinforcement from other people. So like, learn to say no a little bit, but obviously, you love helping other people. It makes you feel good. We're not saying take that completely away. And so it's not about changing yourself so much that now you feel like you're not even an authentic part of yourself for the sake of secure attachment. But it's more about like harnessing what's working for you, accept where you're at, but then take and harness what is working for people who are securely attached for yourself too.
Yeah, and bring those tools into your communication and relationships. You know, for the anxious attachment, put the oxygen mask on first. Like we need to take care of ourselves before running around pleasing everyone else.
Exactly. I mean, I love that analogy. It's just like that. There's a reason why they say that in the safety briefings on planes, because if you try to help somebody else, you might like die in
pass
the process,
out,
pass out because you're not actually breathing. And I think that that's something that's really important for us to reinforce.
In the research for this book, was there anything that stood out to you that was really surprising and interesting?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I think that because there's been so much focus on romantic relationships, like what I found to be really interesting and surprising is just how much it can really affect all the different areas of your life, but even how much you dream, like how much you dream and what you vision for your life. Like when you ask those big questions, like the big miracle question of like, if you woke up the next day and you had the life that you wanted, what would it look like? What I find is that some people with insecurity insecure attachment, they just tend to have more difficulty dreaming big and like really envisioning a life where like things are relatively optimized. Like their dreams tend to be a little bit smaller, or they tend to be either dependent on other people or too dependent on themselves. And so that, I think, is something that people need to know, because, again, in pop media, we always hear it being talked about in romantic relationships. And we've already talked about why that is so interesting and tantalizing for people. It makes sense. It's like the most intimate relationships for most people. But it shows up in so many areas. It shows up in like just at the base level, what you think is possible for you. And I think that that is so important for us to address.
Yeah. And you mentioned it earlier, the secure attachment doesn't believe that they're not worthy, doesn't believe that good things shouldn't happen to them. And so much of our insecurity in the other insecure attachment styles has that belief that I'm not deserving, I shouldn't feel loved, I shouldn't speak out, I shouldn't achieve such big things in my life. I need to be focused on helping others achieve big things, or they're worthy.
Exactly. And the self-sabotaging behaviors and patterns come from that. Because when you do achieve something good, you're like, oh, well, something's not right. Like, and then subconsciously, you do things to mess it up or to take it away. And then, of course, once that does happen, you're like, aha, see, didn't deserve it in the first place. That's why it went away. But we don't realize that our own behavior patterns and our thoughts are contributing to that.
Beautifully put. So where can our audience find the book and the quiz and learn their attachment style?
So you can follow me on social media at Dr. Judy Ho, or you can go to my website. I always have free resources on there at drjudyho.com, and you can find it wherever books are sold. Most people get it from Amazon, so it's available there.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Me too.
This week's shout out comes from Daniel, and I'm going to let him tell you for himself. Take it away, Daniel.
My name is Daniel, and I'm a manufacturing engineer. My overall experience with the X Factor Accelerator program has been excellent due to effective teaching and a supportive community of like-minded individuals. Since joining, I've cultivated deeper connections with my friends, family, and colleagues by implementing the conversational techniques learned in the program. These deeper connections have made my life more fulfilling, both personally and professionally. I would recommend joining the X Factor Accelerator program because the excellent teaching and consistent accountability ensure you will grow into the person that you want to become.
Daniel, thank you for the kind words, and it's been our pleasure to work with you.
If you listened this far, my guess, it's because you are ready to master communication and grow your wolf pack.
Stop wasting your time trying to figure this out on your own.
Stop putting off your best self and start building your future now.
The X Factor Accelerator is the ultimate solution for analytical men ready to take action, build their wolf pack, and find the one. Weekly coaching, implementation sessions, and a personalized curriculum designed to skyrocket your confidence, connection, and networking skills.
With 17 years of expertise and over 10,000 clients satisfied, including executives, military personnel, and men just like you, the Art of Charm has honed the art of transformation.
Imagine reading any room, forging meaningful connections, and attracting the partner of your dreams. Scientifically backed lessons to unlock skills and become a super communicator. Break free from the ordinary and step into the extraordinary.
Join the Art of Charms X Factor Accelerated today and unlock the secrets to your success. Visit unlockyourxfactor.com and learn more and take the first step towards a brighter, bolder future.
The Art of Charms X Factor Accelerator, where confidence meets connection. Apply today at unlockyourxfactor.com. All right, before we head out, a huge thank you to our producers, Michael Harold and Eric Montgomery. Can you do us a quick favor? Can you rate and review this podcast in your favorite podcast app? It means the world to us, and it helps amazing guests like Judy stop by.
All right, now go out there and have an epic week.